Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is Dr. David Black, Director of the American Mindfulness Research Association. My guest today is Dr. Judson Brewer, Associate Professor in Schools of both Public Health and Medicine at Brown University. He is the Director of Research and Innovation at the Mindfulness Center at Brown. His research focuses on addictions treatments and the development of app-based interventions for smoking cessation, with a particular emphasis on mindfulness training. He has authored multiple books, to name a few, The Craving Mind, published in 2017, as well as a New York Times bestseller, Unwinding Anxiety, published just this year. I want to welcome you, Dr. Brewer. You are a leader in the field in applying mindfulness for addictions. Cigarette smoking in particular is a hard behavior to create cessation programs for. Some of your work that I find most interesting is the development of your apps. And I know you may not recognize your impact in this way, but I think it's such an important thing to be able to do. I've seen a lot of poorly developed apps, and I don't think this is the case here. So you have developed this for smoking cessation. Quitting for smokers is not easy. No, what was your motivation? I mean, you have so much to bring to this field, but if we're just talking about apps and bringing mindfulness to the world at this large scale, why is an app so good at this time?
Well, there are a number of reasons. And we actually started developing this back in 2012. So people really hadn't been thinking about digital therapeutics. I certainly hadn't been until a couple of conditions came together. And one of the conditions was that as a clinician, I was really struggling with helping my patients quit smoking. And so I was struggling. Another was that I remember teaching a class at the medical school. I was at Yale at the time, and we were having to teach the five A's, which are, you know, kind of this evidence, the most evidence-based, you know, way to help our patients quit smoking. I can't even remember what they are because they all start with A, but it's supposed to be a helpful acronym. But I was thinking, God, is this really the best that we have? And, you know, like the success rate for somebody to quit smoking after a year, you know, if just the general person off the street tries to quit, as you know, and you probably talked about it, is like 5%, you know, it's terrible. Even the best treatments, you know, it's like, oh, we got a 30%, you know, quit rate or whatever. So it's really, really challenging to help people quit smoking. And I think there are a number of reasons that this is the case. We don't need to go into all of those. But just one as an example is that, you know, somebody that smokes a pack of cigarettes a day, that's 20 cigarettes a day, they're reinforcing that habit 20 times a day. And you can't, you know, think of any, you know, you can't smoke. I mean, it's maybe somebody could, but try smoking crack cocaine 20 times a day, you know, try drinking 20 pints of alcohol a day. You know, it's just really hard. People that use heroin can use a lot. So, you know, it's hard to use any other drug and function. Whereas this drug you can use and you can function. In fact, you know, people get scheduled smoke breaks so that they can function better. I mean, ironically, it's because they're addicted to the nicotine that they need the smoke breaks. But that's one reason. You know, it's really challenging. I really was struggled as a clinician to help my patients quit smoking. And I just wasn't that impressed with the ideology around a lot of the smoking cessation treatments. You know, it's kind of like willpower. You know, what we're taught in medical school is tell your patient to set a quit date for 2 to 3 weeks out, you know, give them some patches or some smoking cessation medication and basically say, buck up, camper, good luck, quit and tell me how that went. And, you know, on average, doesn't go that well. You know, people really struggle with quitting. So that's one reason. Another reason is somewhat serendipitous is, you know, as I started studying habit change in my lab, I was realizing that, you know, patients don't learn to smoke in my office, right? They don't learn to get stressed. Hopefully they don't learn to get stressed or anxious in my office, which are big, you know, triggers for smoking. And so the way that we form habits is through, you know, this reinforcement learning process, trigger, a behavior and a reward really is all we need. You know, like you get stressed, there's a trigger, you smoke, and you feel a little better, there's the reward. So that gets reinforced very easily, but it gets reinforced in a particular context. This system was set up in our brain not to help us learn how to smoke. You know, ironically, nicotine's a toxin. So aside from all the additives in cigarettes, nicotine was developed by Pletz. You know, the lethal dose 50 of nicotine is very small. It's a very toxic chemical. So plants developed this so animals wouldn't eat them. And ironically, as humans, we learned to cultivate them. But this whole system was set up to help us survive. It's set up to help us to remember where food is so we can get it, find it again, and then to remember where danger is so we could avoid it. So it's, you know, setting down context-dependent memories. So we're already swimming upstream by trying to help people quit smoking out of context. So the question was, you know, back then was, hey, could we package evidence-based treatments and deliver them in context? That's where the digital therapeutic idea came. And honestly, it came, you know, with us. I was working with somebody who was a documentary filmmaker. And she said, hey, you know, have you thought about making, because we had just finished a clinical trial, our first one. So, you know, always need to take these first trials with a grain of salt. But we had gotten, you know, five times the quit rates of cognitive therapy of like the American Lung Association's freedom from smoking. So we'd gotten 31% and at, I think we looked at 4 months, and then the active comparator, it was like 5 or 6% at that rate. So we had very good quit rates, and that was in person. So we, you know, it's hard to scale in-person treatments. It's hard to train people to deliver programs. One of the concerns, and I can say this about my own study, is, you know, you get good people to deliver the treatment, and then in one study it looks great, and somebody tries to replicate it, and it falls on its face because it's really hard to train people to deliver these programs. So all of those things make it important to develop something that is scalable and something that importantly has high fidelity. And by definition, a digital therapeutic has 100% fidelity because you know exactly what everybody's getting. In fact, you can know exactly how much everybody's getting. You can get down to the second in terms of dose if you're thinking of a cognitive treatment. So that's why, you know, context matters. You know, delivering something in context is really important. Fidelity matters, and scalability matters. You know, it's really important from a public health perspective to be able to deliver, to develop something that is that can be delivered at scale at low cost. And the only way that I know right now to do that is through digital therapeutics. You know, if everybody has us as a smartphone, and most of the population does, even low income populations are more likely to have a smartphone than a computer. You know, so if everybody has these things, you know, these, as Cornel West puts it, these weapons of mass distraction, you know, why don't we use them for good? let's instead of giving them another video game, let's give them a digital therapeutic that might even, you know, or that we can at least test to see if it works.
That's well put. Yeah, those are key elements for public health that you mentioned. And this ultimately led to a program called Craving to Quit. And you helped develop that. And why did you find, so you were talking about your clinical practice, and this is something I really appreciate with you, and you see it from the MD physician perspective. And I, in my trials, I work with physicians and I learned this very similar thing. It's like, well, we take the addiction medicine courses and, you know, we do some, what we might call motivational interviewing light. We set some quit dates and we give freedom from smoking and NCI and similar psychoeducation, and you know, they're on their way. And they report like that doesn't really work too well.
They're on their way to relapse.
Yeah, it doesn't really work too well. And I found it interesting. I want to see why you think mindfulness plugs in so well for this group. But in a trial that I'm running right now, it doesn't use Craving to Quit, but just, you know, a universal digital oriented app that's kind of popular. I won't name it here, but we have a lot of smokers. I don't know what treatment group they are in because we haven't revealed that yet, but they're saying like something changed their life and it was only in 2 weeks. And I'm like, really, really something changed your life? And so I still don't want to believe it, and I won't believe it because we see a 50% at this point, the trial's only midway through, quit rate within, you know, that date and sustaining for a month. I don't want to believe it seems too easy. So let's pretend it's not that easy. I mean, there's something happening here. And for some people, what might be, what is like craving to quit inclusive of like, is it mindfulness as the central training element, or you say it's a combination of things? Like, what is it and why is it so workable in some ways?
Yes. So mindfulness is really the central element, and the, you know, mindfulness can mean a lot of things to different people. So let's be really concrete here. I think of it as, you know, awareness. You know, mindfulness has this component of awareness, but also an attitudinal component of curiosity. I think of them as two sides of the same coin. You know, you can be aware and you can be judging your experience or running away from it or holding on to it. Or you can be aware and simply curious. Oh, this is what's happening right now. And one thing that I'd been exploring, so as a clinician, I get to, for better or for worse, pilot test a lot of concepts on my patients, right? It's like, oh, let's try this out. Let's see if this works. Let's see if they get it. Or if they're like, what are you talking about? You know, and for all of those, you know, it's probably 80%. What are you talking about to the 20%? Oh, yeah. We can hone in pretty quickly. You know, it's kind of like iterative pilot testing with single, you know, N of one studies. And so here I was, the key element is really awareness. And so if you look at reinforcement learning, or more specifically, there are these two researchers from the 70s, Rascorla and Wagner. You're probably familiar with their work on reinforcement learning. And what they developed was this formula that's still at play today. It's still, you know, the dominant paradigm, which says, you know, you're not going to change a behavior without changing the reward value of that behavior. And the only way to change the reward value of a behavior is through awareness. And when I saw that, I was thinking, oh, that's, you know, that's how mindfulness helps people change behavior. And in fact, you know, we'd written about this a while ago in a more of a theory paper. The Buddhist psychologists wrote about this. Well, they didn't even write about it because there wasn't paper at the time. You know, in their oral tradition 2,500 years ago, in the Pali Canon, there's this description about exploring gratification to its end. Something like, if I, you know, the Buddha speaking, if I hadn't, you know, it wasn't until I explored gratification to its end that knowledge and vision arose. And what that's, if you look at that, it's like, wait a minute, they're talking about reinforcement learning. They're talking about these Rascorla-Wagner models before Rascorla and Wagner were even, you know, thousands of years before these two people were even born. And the idea here is exploring gratification to its end. If you don't see how rewarding something is right now and it's a habit, you're just going to repeat it, because it's, that's why we set up habits, is you set down the reward value and then you forget about the details, right? And so you don't have to revisit that in your brain. Your brain can be focusing on other things. So what I had my patients start doing was paying attention as they smoked cigarettes. And universally, and I say this because I get this question all the time. People say, well, what if they paid attention and they're like, wow, that tastes good. I've never had a patient come in and say, thank you, Dr. Brewer. I never realized how delicious cigarettes are. Now I smoke two packs a day. No. Cigarettes taste like crap, even when you flavor them. You know, vaping aside, because the vaping folks have really tried to get past this aversive quality. But when you pay attention to a cigarette, it does not taste good. And when you pay attention and you realize that it does not taste good, you've explored gratification, quote unquote, to its end. And we start to become disenchanted with the behavior because our body and our brain is saying, wait a minute, why are you doing this? This doesn't feel good right now, right? Certainly there's the nicotine deficit that kind of drives a lot of this, you know, got to get that nicotine. But this is also where, if you look at medications like varenicline, which is a partial, you know, nicotine receptor agonist, when you block that dopamine effect, people really report, wow, I never realized that cigarettes really taste that bad. And so when they can really focus on that, you know, the present moment experience of smoking a cigarette, they realize, wow, this is pretty bad. So that's what we really focus on. You know, first we teach people the habit loop around smoking. You know, it's like, oh, you know, if you don't know how your brain works, you can't work with it. And so we start by teaching them, you know, what's the trigger, what's the behavior, what's the result, so they can see how they are reinforcing the process. That in itself, that psychoeducational piece is really helpful for people, because most people don't know how habits are formed. And it takes literally 3 minutes. We have a 3-minute animation that drives this key point home. So they know where to start. That's the first step. The second step is having them pay attention as they smoke, right? And they can start to see, oh, wow, this is not very rewarding. And in fact, we have a paper under review. My postdoc, Veronique Taylor, we have this thing called the wantometer, you know, like how much do you want a cigarette? And they can map it out, but it also helps them really go through this mindful smoking exercise. So they pay attention as they smoke, and we can calculate the reduction in reward value by plugging their contentment levels after they smoke into these Roscoe-Wagner models. And it really doesn't take that long for that reward value to drop significantly. And that correlates with people dropping the number of cigarettes that they're smoking. So that's the other piece that we explicitly focus on is, you know, don't tell yourself to quit smoking, because they've all tried that. Just pay attention as you smoke. What are you getting from this? You know, it's as simple as that. What am I getting from this? And then the third piece is we bring in a lot of curiosity to help people write out cravings, so that they can learn to be with the sensation of a craving and not be caught up in it. You know, I remember I was working at the VA hospital, and I had a patient who came in who literally said, "Doc, if I don't smoke, I feel like my head's going to explode." And I was thinking, oh God, what do I do? So we went up to the whiteboard in my office and I said, "Describe what head exploding feels like." And he started describing it, you know, like tension, tightness. And I was like, is it getting higher, you know, higher, stronger and stronger? And so we just drew this arrow as it was going up, as he was describing this. And then within a minute or two, it kind of peaked. And then he had this look in his eye. And then it started, you know, he kept describing, he's like, oh, it's starting to go away. And he's like, I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, I usually smoke a cigarette when it gets really strong, but I didn't. And it went away on its own. And here, he was, you know, so we were just co-creating this curiosity, right? So me taking notes as he was describing it, but it helped him map out that cravings are made up of these physical sensations and thoughts that certainly get stronger, but then go away. In fact, I've had patients map out. I was like, have you ever had a craving that's last forever? No, because otherwise it would still be there. But also when they have a strong craving, I say, get a stopwatch and just map it out. And I think this was somebody in our eating program, but basically she said the longest she had a craving was 12 minutes. You know, so people can map it out. Oh, you know, when they get curious, here are these physical sensations that make up of a craving, and they come and go on their own. I don't have to smoke. And that gives them tremendous freedom, because they see they can be with their cravings rather than needing to do something to make them go away. And that is a game changer for many of them.
Yeah, that point reminds me of my daily morning routine with coffee and getting caffeine. Because I go to bed assuming that tomorrow is going to be a fantastic morning because I can get access to caffeine. And then on those days that I played that game and I went to that logical extension that you talked about, and it's like, wait, I really doesn't taste very good. And my wife the other day was like, this tastes terrible. This is really bad coffee. And I was like, no, this has got to be great coffee. I want it to be great. But it's amazing. If you don't actually even tomorrow, and there's sometimes I'll do this, I'll just be like, okay, I'm going on a coffee fast here. And it's like, wait, why do I even do this? So just like you're saying, that habit piece that infiltrates every moment of your life, and there are time expectations and around it and schedules and feeling and affective states that you presume are associated with it, but kind of unknown because they're momentary. I can feel exactly what you're talking about. And this is a challenge, right? Because, and it seems like you're offering some curative elements here, which is just by paying attention to that process, like I was showing with the caffeine example and with smoking, it's like, oh, you'll see the rising and falling of all of these cravings, the drives, relinquishing of those cravings and drives. Like, so you could observe that whole thing. Really good point. And so just if we focus on that, working with patients and people who are trying to quit, you're saying that's enough for some people to make the attempt. Now, what about the carry through? Because now I'm thinking about my life months at a time and years at a time. And can I manage all of that, what you just said, through awareness on a daily basis?
So here I would say yes. And I say yes, both theoretically and empirically. So the first piece to keep in mind is, and this is something that anyone can explore. I'll talk about smoking, but I'll talk about other examples just in case, you know, folks listening haven't smoked. So when you pay attention to a cigarette and realize that it doesn't taste as good as you imagined, you can't undo that, right? It's a quantal shift. I think of it, I call it the Santa Claus effect. You know, it's like the little kid, you know, that goes to the mall and they still believe in Santa Claus. And then they reach out for the beard and the parents are like, no, don't pull the beard. Because suddenly the house of cards of Santa Claus being real crumbles as soon as the kid realizes that this is just some dude with a fake beard, you know, so the parents can figure out what the kids want for Christmas. So that disenchantment moment can't be undone. Kids can't suddenly, you know, pretend that they believe in Santa Claus anymore because they don't, you know, at some point they just don't. That's what happens with cigarettes. Now, it doesn't mean that people suddenly quit smoking, although I had a guy that was smoking 30 cigarettes a day. And within 2 days, he cut down to 10 because he was just paying attention to all the moments where he was smoking. And ironically, you say coffee, because one of those was that he said that he would smoke a cigarette after he drank coffee to cover the bad taste of coffee in his mouth, the bitter taste. And he realized he could just brush his teeth. So that cigarette was gone forever because given the choice between smoking a cigarette and brushing his teeth, it was a no-brainer. It was more rewarding to brush his teeth. So there, you know, it is theoretically possible, but I see this pragmatically as well. When we become disenchanted with something, unless suddenly it magically truly becomes rewarding again, our brains don't, you know, they don't go back. Now, it's not to say that we'll never, you know, we realize something's not rewarding, if we are in the habit of doing it, we're not paying attention, we might just do it habitually again. So it doesn't mean that everybody magically quits and stays quit forever. But each time we bring in that element and we pay attention as we're doing the behavior, that reinforces you can think of it as, you know, just becoming disenchanted with it, right? That disenchantment gets reinforced more and more. Now, the other thing from an empirical standpoint is if we've done something, say for 40 years, so I had a patient who had smoked for 40 years and he'd smoked about a pack a day. So we calculated the number of times that he'd reinforced the behavior. Are you ready for this? 293,000 times, right? So that's remarkable in terms of how strongly that habit could get set up. And the first time he paid it, you know, I had him pay attention. He was like, how did I not notice that before? Well, it was a habit, right? So we can wake up, but it can take a long time for us to wake up. And our brain gets a ton of data points for the habit. So it has to truly be convinced, you know, and it's not an intellectual convincing, it's through direct experience. But sometimes it can take a couple of times for our brain to be like, is that true? Is that really real? You know, because it's fighting two data points against 293,000 data points. So that's a piece where it can take some persistence, but the persistence is really just gentle, you know, perseverance around paying attention and being curious. Okay, what am I getting now? What am I getting now? So that's smoking. We don't need to smoke to survive. So this is where it gets even more interesting. We can do the same thing with things like overeating. So for example, we have this other digital therapeutic called Eat Right Now to help people with emotional stress and overeating. And so Veronique ran the same type of study we created what we call the craving tool in the Eat Right Now program that helps people pay attention as they eat, and we can calculate the reward value. It only takes 10 to 15 times of somebody paying attention as they overeat for that reward value to drop below zero. And this is particularly interesting for two reasons. One, it makes a lot of sense that if you spent your life overeating or smoking or whatever, you know, you'd think, well, doesn't it take a second lifetime to undo that? But that's not how our brains work. Our brains have to learn to adapt quickly. You can't be chased by a saber-toothed tiger or whatever 20 times before you learn that that thing is dangerous, because you won't survive. You've got to learn to adapt very quickly to your environment. And our brains are really plastic. They're good at adapting quickly if they get a very clear signal. So here, if we can really pay attention, we can get that clear signal and change that reward value pretty quickly, because our brain says, I don't need more evidence. You know, I get it. And so that's one interesting piece. The second interesting piece is we have to eat to survive. And so you'd think, boy, you know, I think it's really challenging to help patients quit smoking. It's even more challenging with overeating and stress eating, because it's not an all or none thing. You know, it's like, you don't have to smoke to survive. You do have to eat to survive. So how do you work with that? So here with overeating, for example, we can help people find that pleasure plateau where it's like, you know, is this bite as rewarding, more rewarding, or less rewarding than the last bite? So they can measure that reward value in real time, because their body's giving them signal, especially if they're hungry, that says, hey, calories, you know, but at some point that's going to plateau. And that's where we can pay attention and stop eating before we overconsume, because the overconsumption, when we pay attention, doesn't feel good, right? That's our body saying, hey, you overdid it, buddy, you know, back off next time. But if we don't pay attention because we're numbed out or whatever, we're never going to learn it, and it just becomes a habit, right? And we get this almost this learned helplessness where we're like, oh, I just overeat. That's just what I do. When we pay attention, that reward value can change pretty quickly. And so I highlight that. We actually just published that paper with the reward value in eating. I highlight that because this can be true, not just for things like smoking, but any behavior where we can start to find that sweet spot between where it's helpful, like getting food in so we can survive, and where it becomes harmful, where it becomes overeating, where we are at an unhealthy weight or something like that. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And so I'm assuming the second part to this, and in reading on your program, that you have to address the affective elements and the craving elements, that people will still, it's not like this is going to dissolve and like the next day the person's like, oh, I'm aware now. I have no more of this discomfort in life and the urges and the cravings to do something that I'm used to. And we can all imagine, you know, I can imagine from my perspective, like waking up and just wanting a cup of coffee. I just want it. And I want to address that, right? So I'm not craving as strongly per se, but I'm still wanting that thing. And now that thing is taken away. And so what do I do now with time? And the human mind still has to account for this gap where they're just, okay, I'll try to get through my day, but it just doesn't feel as good to get through this day. And it seems like you're using something that folks in the field know about, but maybe many don't, RAIN. Which is actually addressing discomfort, right? Do you want to talk about that piece?
I'd be happy to. And I think this is RAIN's an indicative of a greater concept, which is, you know, if we let go of something, our brain, you know, because it's based in reward value, you know, it says, oh, I'm not excited about this, give me something better, right? And so it says, fill the gap. So here we could fill the gap. So for example, a lot of my patients with addiction, they'll fill the gap of their previous addiction with things like exercise, because it's more socially acceptable and certainly generally healthy to exercise. But if they become addicted to exercising, not healthy, especially if they get injured from overuse, for example, because then their brain says, well, let's go back to the other thing because you can't do this anymore. So if we just provide a substitution strategy without really getting the core elements and getting at the the heart of the mechanism, then we can really, you know, fall back into these old problems. So here, it can be really helpful to keep in mind that our brain is always, I call it the BBO, the bigger, better offer. Our brain is always looking for that BBO. And what I would suggest is that we can actually find an intrinsic bigger, better offer, meaning something that's inside us. And that's important because we're less likely to become habituated to it, right? If it's, you know, for example, if we distract ourselves when we have a craving by looking at, I don't know, cute pictures of puppies, right, on Instagram, our brain gets habituated to that. Oh, yeah, I get it. They're cute. And then it says, give me cuter puppies, you know, and puppies and kittens, puppies, kittens, and babies, you know, it just goes on and on and on because our brain is set up to habituate. So it could, that's part of the learning process, right? So
here we can find that video if we did a search right now.
Puppies, babies, and
give it to me all the cutest things of all time.
Right. So there we can ask ourselves, well, what don't we become habituated to? And curiosity itself is one thing that we don't become habituated to. And we can compare curiosity to craving. And, you know, certainly I can ask you to give me the socially acceptable answer, but which one feels better, having a craving or being curious about those sensations?
I hope the second.
Yeah. Well, just going back to the story of my patient whose head was going to explode, right? We brought in curiosity in that moment. And so he was able to ride out a very strong craving, like a head exploding level of craving, with curiosity in real time. He was able to do that without us naming it. But that's what gets at, that's really what the essence of this RAIN practice is bringing in curiosity. So just to walk us through it. So RAIN stands for recognize, allow, investigate, and note, right? And this is an adaptation of a RAIN practice that was, I think it was originally developed by Michelle McDonald and then popularized. Tara Brach did a fabulous job of making this very popular and accessible through her writings and her teachings. And the N in that case was non-identification as a concept. For beginners, I thought that might be a little much for people to bite off. So I brought in a different Mahasi Tao practice called noting. So I'll walk through these. So recognize is first, you know, if we have a craving and we don't recognize it, you know, we're lost. We're on autopilot and we're just going to do it. So we've got to first recognize, oh, there's a craving, right? Once we recognize it, often when there's a craving, it's unpleasant. And unpleasant things, our brain is set up to signal, you know, oh, is that dangerous? And let's make unpleasant things go away as quickly as possible. That's what negative reinforcement is all about. So if it's unpleasant, people tend to just grab a cigarette or ignore it or do something to try to make it go away. Here, we take this paradoxical approach. I think of that saying, the only way out is through. And so instead of running away, we've got to turn toward our experience, right? And the best way to turn toward it is not force ourselves to do it, but to really allow the experience to happen. Okay, can I accept that this is happening? Can I allow this to happen, right? And notice the difference between allowing something that's going to happen anyway and, you know, and resisting it. The resistance is actually more painful. And as the Borg from Star Trek said, you know, resistance is futile, right? Eventually it's going to get us. So once we've allowed or accepted that we have a craving, then we can bring in the I, which is investigation. And this is what curiosity is all about. Being curious, like instead of going, oh no, there's this craving, and go, oh, there's this craving. What does this feel like? And from there, it drops us into our direct experience where we can bring in the last part, the note. We can note what's happening in our direct experience. We can note our thoughts. We can note our body sensations. We can note our emotions. And typically between the three of those, that, you know, that's going to help us get a pretty clear idea of what a craving feels like. And as we get curious about it, you know, kind of bringing the investigative, the curiosity element, bringing in that attitudinal component to the noting, we can do just like I described what my patient did. We can note our moment-to-moment craving as it goes up, as it crests, and as it goes away, you know, as it diminishes. And that's where we have the freedom. We see that these cravings are made up of physical sensations and thoughts, and that they're impermanent. They come and go. And we don't have to do anything except to be with them. And just to give you some, you know, so that's a nice descriptor. Is this true scientifically? We published a study years ago now. This was led by I think it was a medical student at the time, Henny Elwafi, who was working in my lab, who did an analysis of our first mindfulness training study or program for smoking cessation, where we had compared mindfulness training to the American Lung Association's program. And he found that the informal mindfulness practices that people were doing moderated the decoupling of craving and smoking. So there's a strong correlation between craving and smoking. You know, if we crave for smoke, makes sense. And within 4 weeks, that correlation was completely gone. And the more people practice these informal practices like RAIN, the more that moderated the decoupling. And in fact, this was even a stronger effect than the formal meditation practices that we had taught people. And that was actually went against what my guess was. I was guessing that it was going to be the formal practices because I learned to meditate, you know, doing formal practices. But it helped me realize how critical these in the moment practices are, because that's, you know, it's context dependent memory. And so it's, you know, if I have a craving for a cigarette, I can't pull my car over and pull out my meditation cushion and meditate on the side of the road. It's, I got to work with that craving in the moment. And if we can work with it in the moment, we can learn that we can work with it any moment. So certainly formal meditation was shown to have some correlation, but not nearly as strong, and it didn't moderate that decoupling. So that was really striking to us, where we could see, you know, these informal practices like RAIN, we can see how they work in, you know, in the moment, right? I could see my patient note his cravings out loud and watch them come and go. And then we can also see this at a population level, how this can formally moderate the decoupling of craving and smoking, because we're not fueling those cravings anymore. Every time we don't smoke a cigarette, when we have a craving, we can learn that that craving doesn't have to drive behavior.
And, you know, I find this interesting, that point about informal practice. And in patient groups that I've run on various trials, especially back in the day when I was still running groups, I wonder if some patients show up to our interventions, and this would go all across the board for patients just seeking treatment also, they show up to be educated and kind of be cared for. And then I wonder if what we find here, because I think it is becoming more common, that it's like the report of the individual bringing this into their life. And that might be a different thing that's happening. It's like those patients that show up, and it's not here for they're not here for pure education. They're here to change who they are. And maybe that's just an indicator of what the person is seeking, right? It's They're actually seeking to change their lives, and others are seeking to show up. And I think that may delineate some of these folks, just observing them through time and who shows up. And some trials or some programs, health education programs in the community, you know, people bring their families because they want to do an event together. Mm-hmm. And so what is that piece? You know, I'm always intrigued by that because you study habit. Yeah. What is it when people finally show up, or the patient finally shows up, and now they want to participate? Because I feel like that's what that informal practice is to a degree. Like they're ready to engage something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really good question. So one thing that's worth exploring, I would say, as a working hypothesis here, is how much somebody is directly experiencing suffering based on whatever the behavior is. So for example, you know, diabetes is challenging to work with because high blood sugar isn't something that somebody typically feels in the moment, right? It's the silent thing. Same for high blood pressure, right? People don't know that they have high blood pressure until they have something happen, like a stroke or, you know, something else that's a result of it. So we as humans learn best through feedback. And so here, I would say when somebody is really seeing very clearly that something is causing a problem for them, they're literally getting the negative reinforcement to say, do something about this. And I've certainly seen this, you probably have as well. They'll come in saying they've tried all sorts of things. And they get more motivated the more they've crossed things off the list that haven't worked. Because they, you know, it's like, oh, that didn't work. Now I'm quote unquote desperate. I'll try anything. And the other thing is when they see that something works, that provides the positive reinforcement to do it again. So my patient, going back to him, when he saw in real time that he could write out a craving, that was very reinforcing for him because he felt, you know, it increased his self-efficacy. He felt like he could do this. So some people come in where they've really seen very clearly that there are, you know, so many negative effects, whether it's their partner saying, you know, your breath is terrible, or, you know, if a lot of people when they have newborn children, that's a big motivator for them to want to quit smoking. So there's something that's driving that. Now, I would say, and as you're pointing out, there are a lot of people that don't reach that point yet. You know, if a cigarette gave us cancer after smoking one cigarette, it wouldn't be a problem. I mean, the cancer would be a problem, but smoking addiction wouldn't be a problem because nobody would smoke because the negative consequences would show up so quickly as immediate results that nobody would do that. But as humans, you know, we have all these mechanisms in our brains that kind of deny probabilities. We can't just handle probabilities. Our brains don't work well with probabilities. So the distant possibility of getting cancer or emphysema is not enough compared to the immediate effect of the reward of getting that nicotine when somebody has a nicotine deficit, when they're jonesing for a cigarette. So here too, and you brought this up, I think, at the beginning of the conversation, we can bring in motivational interviewing elements where we ask, you know, help people explore what they're actually getting from smoking, you know, explore that gratification. Like, what do you actually get from smoking? You know, and this is where the even paying attention to a single cigarette and really paying attention can really increase that motivation pretty quickly. So wherever somebody is on that readiness scale, I think we can help. This is where motivational interviewing does a great job of moving them up on that scale because they are seeing from their own experience how unrewarding whatever the behavior is that they were just doing habitually. Does that fit with your experience?
It does. And it makes me think about how this would actually look then in, say, clinic. And so both of us are trying to find different ways. I've been trying to figure out ways from a larger healthcare delivery, how to piece this together. And the reason why that's important would be probably by examining the way we wouldn't want it to be. So imagine a smoker comes to quit, sees their primary care provider, and they give them the standard care, which is like, look, I have this brochure and, you know, you should read this. It'll help you like take notes, set a quit date, let's set a quit date. So there's some monitoring and we know this is important. That can have effects on its own right. But then if it turns into, and there's an app and, you know, try your best with that. And then they leave. I could imagine for many people, especially because we were carving out like the RAIN practices and complications, you have to get through the experience and you have to build that self-efficacy. The thing with apps that troubles me to some degree is like, if you just hand it to a patient and you say, work through this, they may give it the 2-minute look and then delete it from their phone. And it's like, there was so much opportunity there for intervention. So I wonder about best integration practices. If they are under primary care, how do you convince them to get far enough with the limited time that a clinician may have to allow them to get through? It sounds like you do this because you get through at least a sitting and an entire craving episode. But if we take this to scale, how might it look in that way? Like, what would be the timing to link up what we're trying to do in our offices with when a person starts using this app and incorporating into daily life?
That's a great question. So let's explore this. The first thing I would say is I'd have to think about how best to scale this piece. But for primary care physicians to have a direct experience of knowing some type of, so we all have cravings. They don't have to smoke cigarettes to do this, but to have a direct experience of becoming disenchanted with something through awareness. So for a primary care physician, it could simply be, you know, their Thanksgiving dinner and remembering what it was like to overstuff themselves versus playing with what it feels like to stop when they're full. So they know from their own experience what disenchantment feels like. And in fact, when I first started developing our, you know, mindfulness training program for smoking cessation, the question I always got at the was, you know, well, hey doc, you know, white educated dude, you know, what do you know about smoking? And they'd always ask, have you ever smoked? And I, you know, I wouldn't lie to them. I'd say no. But if you don't believe that I know what you're talking about by the end of this session, you know, these are live sessions, call me out on it. Nobody ever called me out on it. And part of that was that I would sit down, I wouldn't recommend this, but I would sit down and meditate, try to meditate for 2 hours at a time without moving, because the half-life of nicotine is about 2 hours and the typical smoke break is about, you know, it's about 2 hours. And so my sense was I really need to feel what restlessness feels like with craving. And my craving was to move. I want to move. And I have to say it was really hard. Especially early on when I wasn't turbocharging the curiosity element. I hadn't quite gotten that yet. So it was a little bit more of like, let me see if I can do it, you know? And it's so much easier to bring curiosity in. Oh my God. So, but the bottom line here is if a clinician can have their own wisdom where they can speak from their own wisdom, speaking from if I came to a doc and they said, hey, you know, and they were speaking from their own wisdom, I would listen to them as compared to they're like, hey, you should stop smoking. The shoulds, they're a dead giveaway. You know, we should all over ourselves and we should all over our patient. You should lose weight. You should stop smoking. So we can move away from the shoulds into the wisdom. And here, I think this is very pragmatic where a clinician could spend literally 2 minutes, because the typical PCP clinic visit's like 7 or 8 minutes. So they could spend 2 minutes and really just ask the question, well, what do cigarettes taste like? What do cigarettes smell like when you smoke them, right? And often patients will say, I don't know. And they'll say, well, just smoke a cigarette, really paying attention to every puff. That's the only thing I'm going to ask you to do. Do that at least once and then call me tomorrow. Like, so that it's not like come to our next visit, which could be a month out. Like, call me tomorrow and let's spend 5 minutes, you know, I'll book you for a 5 minute appointment, phone visit tomorrow. And you tell me what that's like so that they get the direct experience of seeing, oh, cigarettes taste like crap. Right. That's very pragmatic. And then they are like, wow, I never realized that cigarettes taste this bad. And now they're motivated to do something. I say, well, there's an app, for example. So if there's an evidence-based app, so I'm not saying, hey, use our Craving to Quit app. Hopefully there are more others that can do the same thing. But as the armamentarium develops with evidence-based programs, so just or Craving to Quit app as an example, they could say, okay, download this app and use it because it will help you in a way that fosters curiosity rather than willpower. It will help you start to work with this. And that's the way we can start to scale this. Because that's taken 7 minutes now, right? 2 minutes in that first visit and 5 minutes for the follow-up. Now there's a 7 minute visit that they can bill twice for, you know, for separate visits, not cheating Medicare, just to be super clear.
Yeah. Well, I like your point. I feel like these are important points to talk through because they are the actual practice. And when we approach physicians who want to participate in something like this, we have to convince them that it's worth everyone's time because you can see this as an extension of what's happening in the office, right? It's like the app is the extension. Mm-hmm. And you brought up a really good point. How do you motivate people enough? Let them see the fundamental principle that you're trying to work towards. And then maybe that will build enough motivation to have them trying this out on a daily basis. Because we can even pull this from courses, MBSR, other mindfulness-based programs.
Yeah.
You know, the first class, it's a mixed bag of who wants to actually do this. People have to figure out what it is that they are about to do. And some people may lose a lot of motivation that first class, like, oh, I don't think I could do this. And then it kind of ramps up to session four when many people report that's like, oh, that's the life-changing event. And there's something interesting about that commitment that I've always wanted to hone down. Like, how can that happen in someone's office in the shorter term? And you bring up a good point, because it doesn't seem like it can ever be perfect with an app, but this concordance that happens between patient and provider, there's a setup that could happen. And it seems you're arguing it's super important for the provider to have some experience in what that is we're trying to get the patient to embody. I liked your example about, you know, sitting meditation, and you said an extended amount of time, 2 hours. Some people may 10 minutes. It's that same.
10 minutes could be as much as my 2 hours for sure.
Discomfort, 15 minutes, you know, 45 minutes. Yeah. And being on retreats also, I've recognized the moments you just want to, like, you don't know who you want to scream at, but you want to scream at the teacher. And it's like, why do I want to scream at anyone? Just uncomfortable. And as you were saying that, it brought that to mind for me. I'm like, oh yeah, that's so strong. Like, why do I want to, like, get up and scream at someone? If a smoker is having someone who's trying to quit, having that same feeling, and there is a cigarette around, it's so easy just to respond or react in that way. I guess we all go to retreats because there's nothing to respond to. There's nothing really out there. And so the environment helps us, but the environment must be so hard for people who are smoking. You can easily get a pack of cigarettes and get rid of that burn. That's just wanting you to, like, your head explode or rip out of your skin that we felt through meditation.
Well, and on top of that, you know, being able to go on a retreat's a very privileged thing, you know, where childcare, you know, finances, everything's in place where we can take a weekend or a week or a month or whatever away to look inward. And many, 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 many people never have that opportunity. So the idea is, how can we make these practices equitable? And part of this is really seeing, you know, what can somebody do in the moment where they don't have to meditate ever, you know? And that's one thing that I'm really hoping to do. And I'm hoping others are doing this as well, is like, how can we make this, how can we focus on the, you know, the, making sure that anybody could do this. They don't have to have, you know, money. They don't have to have time. They don't have to have, you know, and none of this stuff's about intellect, honestly. You know, like, awareness is awareness. It's not intelligence. And in fact, I find that some folks with a lot of intelligence, they get in their own way. Where it's like, you're thinking too much. You're overthinking this, right?
I could see that
could even be a deficit, where it's often a you know, big benefit, but that could certainly be a deficit. So here's, how can we help everyone? How can we help everyone?
And you've been extending your work, as I've been looking at some of your recent papers, and you and a group are moving forward on teen use. Mm-hmm. So some of my early work was in school-based prevention programming. So I was always on the prevention side. I'm in a department of preventive medicine, background in public health. And it's kind of, this made me think in one of these recent papers, it's like, we're also examining a group, if we can move this to teens, who are phone use heavy. It addresses your point that there's so many, I wouldn't call them bad things to do on the phone, but very distracting. And they eat up a lot of time. Yep. What if we could use some of that time with an app? So do we need to adapt this is it readily available for teens, or are we working on adapting it for teens? Where do you see it going? And how do you see it being useful for our younger population?
Yeah. So I'd be curious to hear what you think of this. This was an NIH funded study that we did a couple of years ago. This was in collaboration with Lori Pebert and some others at UMass, where we, you know, did this. We started with focus groups and interviews and whatnot. And we went through every single module of the program with teenagers to see what we needed to adapt. Are you ready for this? maybe we got lucky, but also some of this was what we were trying to make this very accessible. There wasn't a single module that they wanted changed. And so we could do that study and kind of confirm that this would work for teens. And so the short answer is yes, it's available because we didn't need to change anything. And in fact, I would say the teens probably, they're like, oh yeah, I know how to use an app. Whereas there's a disadvantage for some of our older smokers. Now, we try to make the apps very easy to use. So most people, it's pretty user-friendly. But the teenagers are like, yeah, game on. You know, it's about the size of a pack of cigarettes. You know, this thing I'm holding in my hand.
So did they say the language was fine? It didn't need like language adaptations. It didn't need like module shifts in length or anything?
No. And part of this was that I had tried to design it for the common denominator. So we specifically made modules like 5 to 7 minutes in length, you know, so anybody with a short attention span, you know, could use it. So it fit perfectly, you know, for teenagers who tend to have, you know, some of them get a bad rap, but societally, you know, they have this reputation for having short attention spans. I'm not sure that older people have much longer attention spans, but we'll just say, you know, we certainly made it for people with short attention spans. We also made sure that the language was accessible, I think down to a fifth or sixth grade level. So anybody, you know, we weren't using fancy words or trying to teach fancy concepts. We were basically just helping people learn that they have this natural capacity to be curious, and the curiosity is actually fun. Now, if you look at teenagers, they are much closer to ground truth in terms of curiosity than adults, because we kind of get it beaten out of us somewhere in life. And if you look, you know, I think of like 3-year-olds as the perfect curiosity beings, where they're like looking at blades of grass going, oh wow, check that, you know. And as adults, we're like, come on, we gotta go, you know. So, you know, teenagers, they probably are closer to that than folks that aren't teenagers. And so they can awaken their curiosity more and more, and perhaps even more easily than certain adults can.
And your point earlier about reinforcement, where you've had patients over 200,000 times smoke. What about teens? So this is earlier behavior. We're mm-hmm. well aware that teens are smoking for a variety of purposes. And now we are facing a new public health challenge. You know, the market has opened all kinds of e-products, e-cigs, vaping, and you mentioned differences in flavor and why this is becoming even more of a challenge, because some of those fundamental principles of why mindfulness training would work may be slightly diluted, because to be present with something that tastes so good in this circumstance wouldn't fit the mark for how we think this works. Do you have any reservations in that respect? Do you think it's just as fine as if we apply this program for a teen who's smoking one cigarette a week? Or what are your thoughts overall on the complications of younger people?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So on one hand, there's an advantage because they haven't reinforced the habit 293,000 times. But on another hand, it doesn't take that long to form a habit. So, you know, once it's formed, and when somebody has the physiologic dependence, then that, you know, it's there, whether you're, you know, 20 or 40 or, you know, 15, you know, most of the folks in our studies started smoking around the age of 13. I think that's still the average age of onset. So here, I think there are some advantages where they haven't been doing this for such a long time. And we can also look to see, you know, what it is that, you know, like, what are these root causes? So typically teenagers don't start smoking because of the health benefits of smoking. You know, they're doing it to rebel or to fit in, or, you know, there are probably 3 or 4 categories that cover 99% of why teens start smoking, you know, peer pressure or whatever. And so if we can help them be with the root causes of that might have led them down the smoking path in the first place. And some of these honestly are poverty, modeling, you know, and things like that. So as a society, if we're looking at public health, we got to address all of the issues. So it's not just about, you know, here's an app and it's going to solve the world. It's about looking at all the root causes. And so I think it's really important that we look at all of these systematic issues and treat those as well. But on an individual level, I think teenagers can really, you know, they can start to notice what these root causes are. And so if it's, you know, self-esteem, certainly for me as a junior high student, it was like my, you know, my darkest days. And again, it's a very privileged comment, but the, you know, it's like, boy, I was really trying to figure out who I was, and a lot of insecurity, a lot of this and that. So if we can, if they can start to learn who they are in a way that is not dependent on some external thing like smoking, then they are going to become less identified with the smoking. And I say that because the identification piece is one of the last thing that I see go, and one of the hardest for a lot of people to let go. It's like those last two or three cigarettes. And the way they describe it is not, they're not physiologically dependent at that point. Usually the physiologic dependence based on the half-life of nicotine, that really can't be sustained beyond about 9 or 10 cigarettes. You just can't keep enough nicotine in your system to be physiologically dependent. And so below, say, you know, 5 cigarettes for sure, it's all just the psychological dependence. And they describe it in a very common way, which is, it just feels like it was a friend for me, right? And so one thing here, and this can apply to teenagers, but as well as anybody, we can notice that our brains don't like change. And so if we've been doing something for a long time, just because it's familiar, we'll keep doing it. And when we try to change, it can feel uncomfortable, just because change indicates, hey, is there, I got to look to see if there's danger here. Is there something scary? So change itself feels scary. Here we can bring the curiosity in itself, and we can get curious instead of going, oh no, this is different. Go, oh, this is different. And we move into our growth zone where we can learn and grow and start to see, oh, what's it like to step out of this habit of smoking and into a different way of being? And so here it can be really self-esteem developing and boosting to see that we don't have to be reliant on I'm a smoker as an identity.
Yeah, it seemed, that's an important part. What's coming up for me is the importance of decentering, because this is almost the experience of grief. Mm-hmm. To grieve for something, to lose.
It's not
something.
Almost. It is. it is. Like, so keep
it's
going.
A part of a part of us that we have to say goodbye to. Similar, you know, when we have to say goodbye to people in our lives, it felt for me similar to that. That we have to recreate ourselves, and there's pain in that in some mm-hmm. way. And you just had me thinking that, like, to have this early on in life, especially for teenagers, maybe it's something bigger than smoking prevention, smoking cessation. It's a navigation. And once they can, you know, young people can increase their awareness, address states that are uncomfortable with a feeling that there is a bigger self supporting that, and triumph over the feelings of grief when we give things up that weren't great for us, which I could totally feel right now in my body, which are perhaps skills that I wish I also had way early in my life, going to middle school and high school. So I'm glad you're opening up your program for our younger population that may be in need. And so thank you so much for your time, Dr. Brewer. Is there anything on the horizon you want to be talking about? I know you and various teams now are looking at using like smart bands, smartphone monitoring to do, it's basically like direct real-time delivery when people are most in need. Is that what's on your horizon? You have other things on your mind.
well, that's one of them. So, you know, we've done some work where we've done some neuroimaging studies to look to see what the neural mechanisms are around helping people, you know, what's actually happening in somebody's brain when they're letting go of a craving, for example. You know, we've done a bunch of work with experienced meditators, mostly cross-sectional studies, and we wanted to do some longitudinal studies, some prospective randomized controlled trials to see what was actually happening as people learn to let go of cigarettes. And the one-liner on that was, we had this really exciting finding where we found that mindfulness training was directly targeting hubs of the default mode network. And the more their default mode network was deactivating, the more that predicted a reduction in cigarette smoking. And this effect, we compared this to an active comparator. This was the National Cancer Institute's Quit Guide app. There was no correlation in the active comparator group. So this wasn't just the effect of using a smoking cessation app. And in fact, we got a dose-dependent response. The more modules they completed, the better they did. And I think we could account for 58% of the variance when we brought those two variables together with just the number of cigarettes they were smoking at baseline. So a lot of explanatory power, which really is kind of like the holy trinity for me in terms of research, where you link up theory with brain mechanism with clinical outcomes. You know, it's like when you can, it's a happy day when those three things line up. So we want to do more work there. But as you're pointing out, this all points to what are some accessible ways to help people with just-in-time treatment. So one of my former postdocs, Katie Garrison, who's an associate professor now at Yale, has some NIH funding to look at bringing together smart bands, you know, with detecting cravings, for example, which has been a real challenge for a lot of people have tried to do this. It's been really challenging to get a really, you know, a specific and a sensitive signal. So she's doing some of that work to see if we can bring that type of detection technology together with mindfulness training to have a kind of a just in time, like when somebody is having a craving, it can help bring in that R for recognize, you know, oh, hey, the alert goes off and says, hey, are you having a craving? You know, it's funny. There's been a debate for decades around, you know, can there be unconscious cravings? What does that even mean? So if there is something that's subconscious or somebody's just not aware of it. And I've certainly had tons of patients where, you know, they say, well, you know, I woke up in the middle of smoking a cigarette and half the cigarette was gone. And I don't remember anything before it. I don't remember what caused it. I don't remember pulling the cigarette out. I don't remember lighting it. You know, so certainly there's a lot of autopilot that happens throughout the daily life. And so if these smart bands can help people at the point of where they're starting to have a craving, just help them wake up a little bit, kind of shake them awake, and then they can bring in a mindfulness practice, that might be a very effective way to help people work with those cravings at, you know, as they arise. So, you know, a lot of really interesting work that folks are doing, like Katie and other very, you know, very ingenious folks, you know, thinking through these things.
Wonderful. You've made a lot of contributions. I see many more to come and with high public health significance. Thank you, Dr. Brewer. Listeners can find our recordings at goamra.org, goamra.org, where you can support us by becoming a member subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.